Please welcome our keynote speaker for Recovery in the Emerald City, Sheila J.
End up sitting up here. And then I might, you know, I'll stand a little bit. I'll stand when I can and maybe walk around a little bit. But I'm just really, really glad to be here. And thank you, Nicole. Thank you. I find myself so inspired by you. I just think Nicole is just incredibly organized. And, you know, there's just a lot of whistles and buttons, John and Cindy and Nicole, when you're getting something like this off the ground. And it's a special skill set when somebody is really organized in that way. And I'm so well aware of that skill set because I do not have that skill set in terms of the organization thing. And I aspire to it, so I want what you have. So I'm going to be touching base with you because you and I have a lot in common anyway. We teach and write and different things. But thank you. Thank you for making things so much easier. And I, you know, it got chaotic this weekend. I forgot some things and you know, chatted with Nicole. And, you know, and then I got here and they don't have a nightlight, and so I, you know, sent Nicole another text. And this is real credit to my recovery that I was able to ask for help. It is still really hard for me to ask for help. It's much easier for me to give help than it is to receive help. And that's because when you're the one who's doing all the giving, you're in the position of control, right? I used to think it was a real noble thing that it was much easier for me to give than to receive. But you've got all the control when you're the one who's doing the giving, right? My father always picked up the check and liked the control that came with that. So so I was just glad that I could ask for help. Thank you for making it easy. And thank you, John and Cindy, for being in that chair position. That's a lot of work, and I so appreciate it, and I've enjoyed talking with you and look forward to getting to know you better. And thank you, everybody who was involved with this. I know, as I said, I know it takes a lot of people to get it off the ground. And I'm just really happy to be here. And I was so struck when you were reading that, and I was thinking, gosh, and despite all that, I still can just lose it when my husband refuses to put a napkin in his lap, you know? And I just think, gosh, really? That sounds like a lot of recovery to me, and yet still, because it's always those little things that really trip me up, you know? It is. I can drop a transmission on the 405 in 5 o'clock traffic and I'm fine, but I break a shoelace, somebody's going down. I mean, it's always, you know, it's the little things. I'm just telling you, right? It's the little teeny tiny things. And I had a problem with sugar from when I was very, very young. And oh, and somebody's timing, I imagine, correct? Oh, you're in trouble if nobody's timing. Thank you. How much time is it, Cindy? Very, very good. So an hour-ish. So okay. So like around 2. No, no, no. So I'll tell you what. So how about, would you give me a heads up at? So can I have a 30-minute timer and then a 15-minute timer and then a 5?
Sure.
Right. Something like that. I always want to be at a meeting where they say, "Oh, well, how much is your time? 20 minutes? Okay, I'll take 1 and 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 1, right?" And I did it one time, and a person said, "Okay," and I said, "Oh no, I was kidding. No, no, you don't need to do that." No, but so thank you. So like a 30, a 15, and then just let me know when I've got 5 left, eh?
Gotcha.
All right. So I had a problem with sugar from when I was very, very young, and I'd gotten sober in AA and had a lot of bad things happen in a short amount of time behind my drinking. But I was in there for about 3 months, and I turned to somebody next to me and I said, "Do you think you can have a problem with sugar like you have a problem with alcohol?" And she said, "Absolutely, go to Overeaters Anonymous." So I did. And I weighed 200 pounds. And the only reason I'm going to talk about numbers is it's going to give you some idea of what my willingness was to feel my feelings. Because that's the whole shebang in terms of what is my level of willingness to put down the substance or the behavior or whatever it is. If you subscribe to the 12-step model, right? And presumably we all do because we're all here. But it's all about what is it that I'm ready to feel. So that's the only reason. So when I'm talking numbers, that's what it's about, okay? So I went to my first OA meeting, and had I taken the direction that I'd gotten in that first Overeaters Anonymous meeting, my whole journey would have been much different. I certainly wouldn't have been somebody who was sponsoring chronic slippers, because I wouldn't have been a chronic slipper. Because the direction I got, and I'd gotten sober in Lansing, Michigan, and so I ended up in my first OA meeting in Lansing, Michigan. And we were, because I'm from Michigan, right, we were largely influenced by the 12-step program of Bob Smith from Ohio. And their theory was is that you go through the steps over and over and over again, in contrast to the New York cohort, Bill's people, who thought that you actually go through the steps and then you cycle through 10, 11, and 12 for the rest of your life. And both work. And both, because they're both addict types, they're both convinced that they're doing it right and the other group is doing it wrong, right? So, like, you know, note to self, don't ever get into an argument with somebody in a 12-step program. Because, you know, we turn, I know I do anyway. Perhaps I'm the only one. But I turn into a toddler and I just want to win. And it's just, you know, I will triumph or die trying or kill you when you try. You know, I mean, like, nobody wins. So, but I just, I went to this meeting, and there were only about four of us, I think, in the room. And I remember this, the beautiful African-American woman was leading the meeting. And I was so impressed because she was finishing a doctorate in accounting. And I was in what amounted to basically my seventh year of a four-year undergraduate degree. And I just found that so impressive, right, that she was so well-educated and beautiful and you know, well-spoken, just found myself so impressed by her. So I got through the meeting, right, and it was an 11 a.m. meeting, I remember. And again, I'd been sober for 3 months, clean and sober, and then I'd been a year in Al-Anon, actually. So I knew how this worked in 12-step programs. I knew you didn't drink when you went to AA, and you didn't, I don't know what you don't do if you're in Al-Anon, but I better keep going because, you know, again, I'm still pissed off because my husband didn't put a napkin in his lap. So clearly I haven't solved that problem. But I figured, well, in Overeaters Anonymous, it must be that you don't eat, I guess. So I showed up at this OA meeting, an 11 a.m. meeting, and I hadn't eaten. And so now the meeting's over at 12 noon, and so I got to find out what this absence thing is, and at some point I probably need to eat. But so I asked this woman who'd led this meeting, and let's just call her Mary, right? And I said, so what's the story with abstinence? And she said, well, she said, do you have a problem food? And I said, yes, I have an incredible problem with sugar. Hi, Helena. I have an incredible problem with sugar. And I've eaten copious amounts of sugar from when I was very young. And she said, do you think it would be possible for you to not eat sugar today and just eat three meals? And I thought, well, I don't. Possibly, I guess, right? Now, I can't remember if the conversation went beyond that, but I'm going to go on the assumption that it did, because one wouldn't ever want to stop a conversation with a newcomer there, right? You don't want to give somebody that information and then split. But even if Mary didn't continue the conversation, the responsibility was mine. I knew how this worked. Remember? I'd been clean and sober for 3 months. I'd been in Al-Anon a year longer. So I knew how it worked in 12-step programs. So even if it didn't continue, it would have been my responsibility to check in with her and find out, could you sponsor me? Because I knew how this worked here. But that didn't happen. So I remember I left the meeting and I haven't eaten. So I think, okay, three meals a day, no sugar. So I went to a restaurant, had a meal, a breakfast meal, finished the meal, and I went out and I sat in my car and I thought, huh, three meals a day and no sugar. No, it's gotta be more complicated than that. And I proceeded for the next dozen years to complicate it. And I'll come back to that. We'll talk about that. But now let me take you to where it all started for me. So I was somebody who had a problem with sugar right from the beginning. I was the youngest of five children. We were lower middle class, kind of, I guess, and my father had gone to school on the GI Bill, and I just needed sugar. And when I was, it was either four or five, let's say four, I was molested for the first time. I was molested by two different men, two family friends of ours. They were actually cousins. Apparently it runs in the family. But this man owned a grocery store and used to give me inappropriate kisses in the front of the store at the candy counter while my mother was God knows where. And I remember, you know, it was his grocery store, and it was when a grocery store used to be maybe twice the size of this room. And he was a butcher, because I remember he would have the butcher's apron on, and I remember blood on the apron, right? And inappropriate kisses in exchange for candy bars. And this happened for on numerous occasions. And I can remember the day I just thought, well, I'm not going to let him give me French kisses anymore. And I didn't know what they were called. Now I know what they're called. But I'm not going to let him do this anymore in exchange for candy bars. I'm just going to start stealing them. So I did. Stealing was a big part of my story. And I started stealing them. Okay? So let's say 4 years old. Four or five, but let's say four. Well, 3 years later, again, remember, I'm the youngest of five, my oldest brother gets diagnosed with diabetes. And my parents, well-intentioned, but fairly unsophisticated people, just assumed, well, if I've got a kid now who's a diabetic, let's get rid of all the sugar in the house. Except there's a problem, because I've already established 3 years before that I'm willing to steal when I need my drug of choice. So I was off to the races, and I did a lot of stealing. I would always blow through my Halloween candy, then I'd get into my siblings, and then my two best friends were twins, and I was particularly close to one of them, and we'll get to that story later, right? But I would eat their candy. I mean, I was just always amazed. I can remember one time at getting to Valentine's Day, and one of these twins saying, oh my gosh, should I throw away the Halloween candy? And I thought, well, throw it my way, but what are you still doing with Halloween candy? It's February, right? It's time for Valentine's candy, you dingbat. So, I mean, that was my, I just would always blow through sugar quickly, always. And I would take what you had, because just like it talks about in the big book, I have no morals around this. I just don't. And when I was 10 years old, I got molested by the second gentleman. And this was more substantial. So now, right, so let's just look. So now I'm 10 years old. I've already been molested twice. I have parents who are fairly unconscious. I mean, where was my mother in the grocery store? It was just a couple years ago in OA. I kind of put two and two and two together on that. And just, it never occurred to me when I'm driving home with my mom to say, hey, can you have a conversation with him and tell him to knock this off? It never occurred to me. First of all, where is she in the store? I mean, it's not a huge store. Where are you? Where is my mother? Where are you? And I already knew at four, don't bring this up with her. Because that's the pathology. That's the pathology of the ism, right? We call it alcoholism, right? In that it all got birthed out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But when I'm talking about alcoholism, right, the disease, it's the same thing. It's the same thing, right? We all know what I'm talking about. But that's it in a nutshell. There's just total unconsciousness. Like, I already knew, don't talk about this. It never occurred to me to say anything to my mother, first time or when it started happening 5-6 years later. Never occurred to me, didn't even cross my mind. So now we've got real problems because I'm 10 years old. I'm already stealing stuff. I've been sexually traumatized by two different men on a number of different occasions, and I've got nobody to talk to about it. And my two best friends were thinner than I was, and I was a normal weight then. I look at pictures now, and I was a normal weight. I was a cheerleader in junior high, and the first year of my cheerleading, I was the one that went on top. So this idea that I had that I was too overweight, that must not be correct. Now I know that by the time I was in the ninth grade, once I'd started menstruating, right, and kind of the trauma comes up. And the reason that I'm talking about this, and you'll get to it as we have our conversation over the weekend, is first of all, it's just starting to kind of open up in Overeaters Anonymous. There's a lot of sexual trauma associated with eating disorders. I've heard statistics anywhere from 30 to 70%. And I don't do research in the field, so I'll just give you those numbers. I don't know where it is. Let's just call it a big number. But my point is, I know I'm not the only one in the room, right? And I'm going to talk about the whole love and forgiveness thing, right? The whole component of healing that comes as a result, bless you, that comes as a result of working the steps. That's why I'm talking about this. Plus, I'm giving you my big ticket item on my 8-step list, okay? So at any rate, I'm just in trouble. So because I've gone through, I've started menstruating now, so then all the feelings come up. I mean, that's just textbook psychiatry, right? If you had some kind of trauma like that, it's going to come up as a young girl when you start menstruating. So I'm just in trouble now, and I put on all this weight. So now I'm still a cheerleader, but I'm no longer the one that goes on top. I'm a base, right? So I'm the one that leans over so that then the little girls can, you know, climb up on top of us. And then by the time I got to high school, I was just too overweight to be a cheerleader, right? Because the weight just kept stacking up. I mean, that was where it all started really coming on for me. But again, the problem started with the thinker in terms of weight and body image way back when I was a thin girl, but I wasn't as thin as my girlfriends. Are you with me? I mean, you really get it, where it's just all about the thinking. Thinking's off. But it also changed my whole trajectory once I got to high school, because these best friends of mine, and they had, you know, I was always kind of on the outer circle of the popular girls, right? I certainly wasn't, you know, the queen bee in the center, but I was always kind of on the outside. But I decided, once I'd put on this weight and I was no longer able to be a cheerleader, I decided, well, I don't have any value. And I stopped returning their phone calls. Stopped going to events and stuff. I stopped doing that. I had more important things to do on a Friday night. I had to babysit and raid your freezer, whomever you were that had me at your home. So the weight just started packing on. It just came very, very quickly. And those friends fell away because you stopped calling people, stopped returning phone calls, stopped socializing with them. Well, you're no longer friends anymore. So it's just really crazy to see where my eating disorder took me in terms of it was so much bigger than the food and my body. So much bigger. It would be great if having weighing 200 pounds had been my biggest problem. That would be great. Not even close. The same problems that I had when I came in with are the same things I wrestle with today to a much lesser extent, but it's the same issue. I do not love easily, and I do not forgive easily. Those are my problems, you or me. Because if I can't love and forgive me, what kind of a chance do you have, really? I mean, again, just ask that husband of mine. So those are my issues. I'm real clear about that. I'm also real clear that unless I address the food issue, I'm not going to ever get to what the real deal issues are anyway, or I'm not going to have a real shot at kind of unearthing what's below that, what's really beneath that idea that I have that I'm not worthy of forgiveness or that I'm unlovable, right? What's beneath that? That's the really exciting gig here. And if I could eat and still access that, well, yes and yes. But I can't. For me, I can't. So at any rate, the my whole life is changing now. So because now I'm the overweight girl in high school, and it continued in my first couple of years in college. And then I started drinking, and I'd done a little bit of drinking the summer before my senior year, and then drugs. But sugar was always my drug of choice. Sugar remains my drug of choice, right? I always say, if you would line up a bottle of tequila, a line of cocaine, a joint, a carton of Marlboro Greens, and a hot fudge sundae, I would run to the hot fudge sundae. Still would, like hands down. That's always been my thing. That has always been my thing. The other stuff was stuff I did, and I don't at all discount my recovery there, at all. But that was just to keep me distracted. The food, oh, it just calmed me. It gave me a real feeling of calm, just like it talked about in the book, you know? So I am now in real trouble. And then really was tanking in terms of the drugs and the drinking. And then I've ended up in an OA meeting, right, and got that direction. But I decide that despite the fact she had what I wanted, I came to a meeting. She had however much time she had. She certainly had more than me. And she gave me really good information. But I decided that there was something better, and I got this. Those are the three worst words I can say in a 12-step program. I got this, right? You know, that's trouble. I always tell people, newcomer, I say, look, it's okay if you come in here and you've got a plan, if you've got an alternative plan, it's really okay if you come in here. Just tell us your plan. What's that plan? What's that alternative plan that's so much better? Just tell me, right? So, because I had a plan. And the one good thing, though, and this is, I thank God for my participation in those other programs. Because of those programs, I knew that I needed to get a sponsor. So while I didn't end up with Mary, I ended up with another sponsor within a couple of weeks. And I, because I grew up in an alcoholic home, my parents weren't alcoholic, but my grandfathers were, both of them, maternal and paternal. And my father's alcoholic father would pass out at night. My father grew up in real poverty in Flint, Michigan, one of only two white families, right, in this community he grew up in. And the only reason they didn't go hungry is because his father was a butcher. But his dad would come home, drink, and pass out. So my father's anger, right, behind that trauma was very passive, real passive aggression. My mother's alcoholic father was very, very violent. He wasn't even just a child beater. He was a beater-upper. And my mother, as the oldest of those four children, she and a brother 2 years younger got the worst of it. And I have no doubt that it is horrible if you are a child and get knocked around by your father. And yet, if you are a girl and you're getting hit with a closed fist or you're getting belted, and if it's a good night, you're getting belted with the leather part of the belt, not the buckle, right? There's something different when you're a 15-year-old girl and your dad's coming in the bathroom to work you over. There's just something different. So my mother's trauma was much different than her brother, 2 years younger than her. But again, have every, you know, very clear, it's horrendous on both counts. But my mother was just a wounded, troubled woman. She just was. She was just in so much pain. And we'll get to that on Sunday morning. But my parents just did not, they were in over their heads. But because I grew up in that family, I grew up with a real healthy respect for authority figures. I don't argue with sponsors or cops. So I don't. All that stuff, that is not my idea to have five commitments at five meetings. That was some sponsor's idea. I'm just not here to argue. So, and that woman doesn't even sponsor me anymore. Our schedules didn't even work. That was like a month into it, and we just figured out that our schedules didn't jive. But I just thought, well, this is probably a good piece of direction. I guess I'll just just keep doing it. And it is, you know, it's good. It keeps me going to meetings, and I love meetings. I don't go to meetings for any other reason but that I love it, right? I feel the love in the room, and I didn't grow up feeling a lot of that love as a child. And I felt very, very alone. And I just don't want to be alone anymore. I was probably an unplanned pregnancy, and my parents died young. They died in their 60s, died young, right? Died of various ailments, but the reality is they died of alcoholism, right? The pathology, that sense that we have, that fiercely independent sense that says, I got this. I got to figure this out on my own. And even if I don't have it figured out, keep thee away. And it did not bode well for my parents. But I just was doing the best I could. And I thought, because I came through this, remember, I'm 4 years old, inappropriate stuff is going on, Not once does it occur to me to ask my mother for help. Well, how can you flash forward 20 years later and I'm going to hear somebody say, oh, abstinence, here's what it is. Can you do this? I didn't have the ability at that time to just do what was asked of me. I don't argue with sponsors, but I did not have that ability to do that. I thought I had to figure it out. I had to figure out everything in my life up to that point. I had to figure it all out. So it's really no surprise that it would have gone that way. But I got a sponsor within the first couple of weeks, and this sponsor said something that changed my life. So this would have been in February of 1998, which is when I came in Overeaters Anonymous, and she said, start working the steps. And I can't remember, I don't know if we started, the OA 12 and 12 wasn't out yet. That didn't come out until 90 or 91. So that wasn't out. So I don't know where we were, what material. I know there was the original Brown Book, so we were probably doing stuff from there, something. I don't know, doesn't matter, right? Anytime I'm doing exactly what my sponsor asked me to do, I'm working steps 1, 2, and 3. You know, people will sometimes get nervous and they'll say, oh, my sponsor hasn't started me on the steps. Well, yes, she has. Yes, she has, right? Just do what's asked of you. That is that surrender and that restoration to sanity. So I just did what was asked of me. And it became very clear a couple of months in that I wasn't done with the sugar. Why? I wasn't ready to feel the feelings that were inevitably going to come up underneath that sexual trauma, the violence in my home, all the inappropriate stuff. My mother was a rager. She would throw things. She'd throw dishes against the wall. I can remember when my mother was complaining. I was about 7 years old, and my mother was complaining about how much she hated her china and was pulling her china out of the china cabinet and thrashing it on the floor because she hated her china. And I thought, okay, well, I guess you've solved the china problem, you know. I mean, you know, that's going to be a non-issue now, right? But like that's traumatic when you're 7 years old. And again, we were fractured, so I didn't seek solace with my siblings or anything. That's what I just want you to get with this. It would be great if the problem had been that I'm just too overweight. It wasn't. It's all about pain. It's all about the pain. And I wasn't ready to feel the feelings. And my sponsor, God love her, I can't even remember this woman's name, but she said, I don't care if you're not done with the sugar. I just want you to work those steps. And so I get to a 4-step. I'm still in the sugar. And she said, I don't care. Are you right-handed? And I said, yeah. She said, put a pen in your right hand and a Snickers bar in your left hand. And you get that 4-step done, right? The best 4-step advice I ever had gotten, and I give it to all my sponsees, I don't start anybody on a 4-step unless we've scheduled the 5th step. So we start the 4-step, and I schedule that 5th step. It doesn't take a long time, but we'll get to that tomorrow. But at any rate, so I just did what I was told year after year because I wasn't ready to feel the feelings behind putting down my drug of choice. I wasn't ready. There were plenty of times I read 5th steps with food stains on the paper. I remember one time, like pasta sauce, you know, red, it was pretty, I love red. So it was, you know, like on the paper. But I just did what I was told. Again, I'm not here to argue. I'm not reinventing any wheel. And I'm not gonna be alone anymore. I grew up alone, I'm not gonna be alone. So I'm not going to take the risk of rebelling against what somebody is asking me to do and have them cut and run. No, not going to do it. So I just did what was asked of me. Now here's the interesting thing, right? So having done that, 2 years in, remember my top weight's 200 pounds, so now I weigh about 180. I'm 26 years old, and my father had 3 overweight daughters and didn't like it. And he was very verbal about it, publicly. And he didn't do it so much with my oldest sister because she would fight back. She would, you know, basically tell him to jump in a lake. And he didn't want that. So he didn't want to get in the ring with her. And then my middle sister worked for him. He had started his own business. And so she, you know, was his accountant. So he not going to fool around with her. So he didn't have too much of a conversation with her about her weight. But he had quite a few conversations with me. And again, I was ill-equipped to stand up for myself or to limit set or anything like that. I mean, that was way above my pay grade. But I just took it. I didn't know how to fight back. And again, it always was happening publicly. So now I'm 2 years into OA, right? And I've been working the steps, probably been through the steps a time or two at that point. And again, remember, having come from Michigan, I just know that once I finish, we're going to just cycle through them again, do it some other way or work the traditions or do something, you know. And so I'm 20 pounds down. Now I weigh about 180. And I'm at a family event. And I walk by my father. There's probably 30 of my family members there. And there's about a dozen of them who are out here on my sister's front porch of her home. And I walk by my dad. Somewhere I have a picture of him so I can see myself. I know what I'm wearing. And I walked by my dad. And he said, "Well, I see you've lost a little bit of weight, but you've got a lot more to go. Don't let up." And I turned around and I said, "No more. That's it. It's over. You do not talk to me about my weight anymore. It's over." And everybody kind of looked around like, "Oh my God," you know, because nobody talked to my dad like that. And I wasn't being disrespectful. I was really meeting fire with fire, really. And it was never appropriate for my dad to have ever had that conversation. I was getting sexually traumatized yet again by that conversation every time he said stuff like that. But, and there's also, I worked for a psychiatrist for 5 years. There's real trauma that you also do with a daughter, if she doesn't know how lovable and how beautiful she is, and she doesn't have a relationship with her father, it actually births things like promiscuity, check on my resume. It creates real problems. And then you put that on top of the fact that I'd already been traumatized. I mean, it just, and I'm alone, and I got a mother who, you know, throws dishes. I mean, I had nowhere to go. But 2 years in, working the steps, following sponsor direction, because I don't argue with sponsors or cops, I got to stand up to the man who'd bullied me about my weight for my lifetime. And my father never spoke to me negatively about my weight ever again. So that was how I knew that there was something really valuable about the step work, even if I wasn't ready to stop eating. And put that on a little post-it note. And somebody remind me that, because I want to make sure I get back to this, but I don't want to get lost here in the story part here. But that's an important piece of the puzzle. Because I got it, and I didn't realize it then, but looking back on it now, I really realize that that was recovery. And I mean, certainly something had happened because I'm 20 pounds down. So that just means I was a little bit closer to being able to consistently feel those feelings. And I have not weighed 200 pounds since February of 1998. So something was shifting through this process of step work. And that's really important for me to pay attention to.
Sheila, that's 30 minutes.
Very good. All right. Actually, that's not good at all, but so I know that I've got 30 minutes left. Okay. All right. That's good, though. No, thank you. I'm so glad. Thanks, Cindy. So, no, I love you. Thank you. Thank you. That's great. All right. Very good. So that's good. I just don't want to, but somebody remind me about this, because I want to get back to this, about this whole business of step work and eating, abstinence, okay? So I just kept going. And then I had, and I've always had sponsors, and I'm not going to go this alone, and I had a great sponsor, and I'd had a major health diagnosis, and my doctor from UCLA said, "Well, I know diet could have an effect on this. You could do better if you're on the right diet, but I don't know anything." And this guy was a world-renowned researcher on this thing I was diagnosed with. He said, "But I don't know anything about eating." He said, "Most doctors don't." He said, "Go see a registered dietitian." which is what you want to do in the state of California. You don't want to go to a nutritionist. Anybody in the state of California can call themselves a nutritionist. They can put it on a business card. You want to see a registered dietitian, somebody who's studied this. It's a science, right? Food science, nutrition science. So I went and I saw this wonderful woman, and she's still in my life today, and she was actually a member of Overeaters Anonymous, and I used to see her on a weekly basis, you know, professionally for a couple of years. Because I just, again, I had gotten some information about what would be helpful with the diet, and lo and behold, surprise, surprise, one of the things is stop eating sugar. But I wasn't ready. I couldn't sustain that. I couldn't do it. But I wanted some help with her, right? And so it was great, because as I continued working with my sponsor and continued seeing this woman and just kept going through the steps over and over and over again, and then I ended up with a sponsor who really taught me some phenomenal things in terms of scheduling and stuff. She had four sponsees, and she would talk to us every quarter hour. So once somebody at 8, somebody at 8:15, somebody at 8:30, 8:45. And you'd talk to her Monday through Friday, and it was a floating call on weekends. So she was the first person in Overeaters Anonymous that taught me the necessity of that daily contact with a sponsor, like it talks about on page 100 in the big book, right? Never says the word sponsor. That's what anybody who doesn't have a sponsor here always wants to throw out. Oh, yeah, it doesn't say anywhere in the big book. Okay, right, you win. Good. Right now, go get a sponsor, right? And just, it does say on page 100, you know, you and the new man must walk day by day, right? So, I don't know, sounds like a sponsor to me. But I just, and again, do your thing here. I just don't want to be alone anymore. I don't want to be alone anymore. So I've got this great team now, but I'm still, and now I weigh about 155. So I'm 45 pounds down from my top weight. I've been here a dozen years. I can't sponsor anybody. I can't be a secretary of a meeting. I can't be a treasurer. That comes directly from World Service. You can kind of vote down, you know, your meeting can say, okay, can we show of hands if, you know, somebody wants to let somebody be a secretary who's got, you know, 3 hours of abstinence. But you can't do that as a treasurer, right? That comes straight from World Service. They say, no. Got to have 6 months. So I can't do any real substantial work here. I mean, I can be a timer at a meeting. People were willing to entrust me with the timer, right? Don't give her the battery, though, you know? Like, she's got to show up and get the battery. But I mean, you know, it's always strange. And yet I was doing the deal in Al-Anon, doing the deal in AA, so I knew what it meant to show up somewhere and be participating, but I wasn't participating fully here because I wasn't abstinent. And so independently of each other, and they didn't even know each other, my sponsor and this registered dietitian, who I was no longer seeing professionally, but I still, you know, would see her once in a while at meetings, independently of each other, in the same week, but my sponsor is the one I really paid attention to on this, she said, we're going to declare an abstinence date for you. It was the end of May. It was May of 2000. I said, wait a minute, I'm not ready to say. She said, I know you're not. I know, your behavior is real clear about that. Because I always had, you know, I've always been completely transparent about my food. Because I'm just not going to lie. If I'm going to lie about something, I'm going to lie about something more interesting than my food. I'm going to say that Brad Pitt is my cousin, right? Or, you know, I actually went to Yale Medical School, but I just choose to, you know, starve in the entertainment industry in Los Angeles, right? I don't want to be a doctor. I mean, come on. I'm not going to lie about my food. So I've always been willing to be completely honest about my food. So she knew what I was eating and how much I was eating, and I was still overweight. I wasn't as overweight as I had been due to the dozen years of working the steps over and over and over again, following direction, even though it didn't make sense here. I was a worker bee. I'm a drone, right? I just followed direction, and there was a shift. And that sponsor said, we're going to declare abstinence for you. And that didn't make any sense to me, but again, I'm not going to argue. So my abstinence date is May 30th, 2000. But I was still eating sugar periodically, right? But still, like, it was just interesting to see what happened. And I just eventually figured it out, and I finished the steps with that sponsor, and her thing was, is once you finish the steps with her, she says, go get another sponsor, see what someone else has to say. So I was no longer working with her, but I was, you know, still doing this process. And I just kind of came to the conclusion that maybe I was just going to be one of those people who just every once in a while, I'm just going to eat sugar. You know, maybe that's how it's going to be with me. Maybe I'm going to have routinely have four or five, I guess four different sizes of clothing in my closet, depending on what I'm eating. You know, I mean, a lot of that has to do with, you know, which clothing you're wearing anyway or where you're buying it. So I didn't sweat it too much. And I had a boyfriend at the time who became a fiance, who's now my husband. And he didn't care what I weigh. He likes warm body in bed. It's fine with him. So I didn't have any attachment. I guess some real recovery around the whole idea, starting to get a sense of what my value was. Starting to get very, very clear about the fact that anything you're seeing about me isn't telling you anything important about me. So I was starting to get that, and that was good. That was a welcome thing based on where I'd come from and what I'd experienced with my father. So that was huge. But I just followed direction. And I figured, okay, so I guess this is how it's going to go. But in the fall of 2003, I went into a period of going off sugar again. Because I would, you know, go in and out of these periods, right? I guess it's time to stop doing it for a while. And that time I did it after Halloween, because what idiot stops eating sugar before Halloween? So, and it was before Thanksgiving, so it's like, I think I like November 7th-ish. And I just decided to not eat sugar. And I got through Thanksgiving, through the, you know, Christmas, my husband, he's Jewish, he doesn't really, you know, I mean, I got through New Year's, I got through 6-7 weeks. And again, through the process of working the steps, going to meetings, doing all the stuff that my sponsor wants me to do, but I'm not eating sugar. And my husband and I went for dinner, and there's another part of the story, but we'll possibly get to that on Sunday, possibly. So it was Tuesday the 13th, my husband and I went to dinner, and we went to a fancy dinner. We were going to this place in Hollywood, and we were eating a late dinner. Right? I think it was like a 10 o'clock reservation, 10:30. And I haven't had sugar, you know, we have this great dinner, and who knows what happened at the dinner. I don't know, did the waiter look at me cross-eyed? I'm not sure. I just know that, again, he's my husband now, but he was my fiancé. We were engaged for a long time, almost 10 years, right? Another story on the wall. Good story. But for whatever reason, I decided during the course of this dinner that I was going to eat sugar. And I told my husband, I said, you know what? Let's get dessert. And Neil says, he just grabs the table like, okay, because he knows the ride that we're both about to go on. Because it's not like I do this in a vacuum and you're not going to be affected by it. He just, he's petrified, you know. So we call the waiter over and order a dessert. And they put this fancy dessert with all the, you know, nonsense on the plate. I mean, really, come on, just give me a half gallon of ice cream and put me in a dark room with an HBO, right? I'm fine. I don't need all this stuff. But it has all that stuff. And, you know, put two forks down. And my husband and I are sharing the dessert. Remember, I've been off it now for 7 weeks, got through all those holiday seasons, didn't have it. I'm in the new year, and I'm in the sugar again. And my husband and I are sharing this dessert, right? And this is not going well because my husband is eating more than me, and I know because I'm counting bites. I'm counting my bites, and I'm counting his bites. It's not easy, try it. And yet I'm very clear that he's eating more. So now we've got real problem because he's pigging the drug. So it's this horrible thing. I got to get out of here. You know, it's like, now I'm back in the sugar. Because it's a physical allergy, and I've ignited it now. The obsession of the mind never goes away. That's why we go to program for the rest of our lives, because this doesn't shift. But the physical allergy, I was away from it. But now I've ignited it again because I'm in it, and I got to get out of this restaurant. I got to get out now. Waiter, check, check, right? Like, I need to get the check. And I'm saying to my husband, come on, let's go. I got to get out of here. And my husband never likes to valet park. We always got to walk, you know, a half mile. And, you know, as I'm walking to the car, I'm like, you know, trucking. I'm like, let's go, baby. Come on, let's go. I mean, I got to get to the car. I got to get him out of the car because I need to go somewhere and I need to get some real deal stuff. Because my husband has sugar at home, but I don't eat the kind of things he eats. He eats dark chocolate, and there's no fat in dark chocolate. And if I have sugar, it has to be combined with fat. I would only eat a jelly bean if I can deep fry it or dip it in butter. I've got to have sugar combined with fat. He's got nothing at home for me, and I got to get him out of the car. I mean, I am just trucking. I cannot, I'm already working on the lie. I got the lying thing down. I'm a writer. That's my job, is to tell a lie and make you believe me. I so got this covered, and I'm just, you know, and we get to the car. I got the plan, and again, remember, so now I'm two, remember, because the important part of the story, remember, I'm 2.5 years abstinent. Don't forget that. And I've been working the steps, but I got a lie going on because I need my drug. I need it. And I get to the car, and I put my hand on the handle because I'd always figured, right, in and out of sugar, in and out. I figured I don't have a bottom, right? I'm just going to be one of those people in and out, in and out. And my hand touches the handle of the car, and I thought, I am so glad I don't live in a high rise. I thought, wow, where did that thought come from? And in that moment, I got powerlessness. Because I got it that if I kept eating sugar, I could no longer guarantee that I wasn't going to one day take myself out. And I knew a young girl, she was 28 years old, who put a gun in her mouth. She was about 30 pounds overweight. She was 28. Painful. But she put a gun in her mouth because she couldn't stop eating Snickers bars. That had happened 15 years before in my life. So I knew that it was well within the realm of possibility. And I got it in that moment that if I didn't stop eating sugar, if I didn't start to really take this seriously, conclusively take a third step and tell the truth about this, I couldn't guarantee that I wasn't going to one day take myself out. And I got powerlessness. Right? And I didn't do any of the game playing that I was prepared to do because I was planning the lie. Because Neil already knew my games with food. I mean, I don't know why I couldn't just say, look, I'm going to just pop out. You just keep the car running, right? I'm going to go dash in the store. I'll be right back, you know. Going to be carrying a bag. It's going to be heavy, right? Maybe you want to help, maybe not. Right, but just like, I didn't even want to, like, do you see the levels of deception here? And I actually thought that my problem was that I was overweight. Well, my problem was that I was a liar. I couldn't be trusted anywhere. And whatever I'm doing with food, I'm doing in every area of my life. I just had that conversation with a sponsee last night, right? Whatever I'm doing with food, I'm doing in every area of my life. If I'm game playing, if I'm lying, if I'm avoiding, if I'm bargaining, if I'm fooling around, I'm doing that in every area of my life. That's been my experience, and what seems to be the experience of the chronic sufferers I've sponsored over the year. But I already had this going on. I was prepared to tell my husband, let me tell you, this was the worst of it. We just, in the interest of time, I thought, I'll tell him that I've got to get tampons. And I'm going to drop him off at home. He can go in and deal with the dog. I'm going to go back to the store at midnight now and get tampons. But my very evolved husband is going to say, well, honey, I'll go get tampons. My husband knows. He knows get OB, not Playtex. I mean, he's got this down. He knows. He's got the tampon thing down. I mean, this is not, you know, he's going to say, well, baby, let me go do it for you. And I was going to say, no, actually, because I knew he was going to, right? So I'm prepared, right? Lying. I said, no, honey, no, actually,
you know, I didn't want to say anything about this, but I actually just need a little downtime. You know, I just, you know, I'd been to the, I was to, at the doctor. Oh, you didn't know I was, yeah, I was at the doctor earlier today. And, you know, there's like, you know, I felt a little lump. It's kind of, you know, they think it might be just, you know, cysts, but who knows, right? And my husband would be, oh, you know, and be like, no, okay, you know, and then I was pushing it, so now I'm going to be, because you got to be upset. If you're going to lie, you got to, you know, you got to roll with it. They'd be like, no, honey, it's, it probably is cancer. I'm not sure. I just need some downtime. Can you please just go in and get the dog, right, and let me just go, you know, get my tampon, right? I was willing to lie and tell my husband that I had cancer to get to the store and buy chocolate. That's with 2.5 years of abstinence, right? And 14, 15 years of sobriety. But I mean, the thing is when you think about how long it takes to get coiled up, it's going to take at least as long to get uncoiled. So I, that's just where I was. That was the best I had. And that was when that, you know, all that game playing, right, that storytelling, that was before my hand hit the handle of that car door. And I knew. I got it then. So I didn't do any of that stuff. We went home. And I woke up the next day on Wednesday the 14th. And what did I do? I had sugar again. Because I forgot. But on Thursday the 15th, 2004, I don't know what happened. I do not know what happened, but I got relieved of the sugar obsession, and I've never had it since, at 2.5 years of abstinence, right? And it was just following direction. And I said to my sponsor, once, you know, I got a couple months into this, I said, do you want me to start my date over? She said, absolutely not. And this was not the original sponsor who'd had me do this. She said, absolutely not. You were following direction. You're fine. Where are we at on time? Very good, very good. Yep, so 15. Thank. Sorry, so I have 5 left now?
Oh, now it's 1. So
okay.
We've done 30, we've done 15.
Very good. Thank you, my love. Yeah, so just let me know at 10 minutes, please. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Cindy. So I don't know what happened. I have no idea what happened. And people always say, well, what happened, what happened? I say, are you kidding? If I knew what happened, I would write a book, probably be best friends with Oprah, and I would leave Overeaters Anonymous because, I mean, it's scary here. Intimacy is still scary to me. It is. It's still scary. Any kind of intimacy. That's why when people had learned about this long engagement I had with my husband, they'd say, wow, why the long engagement? I'd say, well, I'm afraid. They'd say, what are you afraid of? I'd say, what do you got? I'm afraid of all of it. I'm afraid of all of it. All of it. I did not have the tools. I didn't have the tools. But something shifted, and it was due to the years and years of working the steps. If you subscribe to what we believe in 12-step programs. So I'm just so grateful. Just like Bill says, he just thanks God that he had the willingness when Ebby called him on the phone to answer the phone. First of all, I just think it's a miracle, right, in 1934 that he answered the phone. I know people now who don't answer their phone, and I'm one of them. So, you know, I mean, I just think it's a miracle when you think about it. And I'm just so, so grateful that I was willing to take my sponsor's direction. I was willing to get a sponsor. I started working the steps, even though it didn't make sense to me. I kept eating sugar and kept doing it year after year after year after year. You know, I've done 45, 54 steps at this point. And trust me, due for another. So, I mean, I'm here. I'm a lifer. I'm in. I am so in love with this. But I'm so grateful as I look back on it and I see all of the wonderful things that happened when I was willing to be out of good ideas, which is what I tell the chronic slippers that I sponsor, be out of good ideas. Newsflash,
you don't have a good idea in your head about how to be absent anyway, but if you, even if you think you do, just be out of it. Be out of that good idea, because it's not a good idea. And stand on my shoulders. Don't do what I've done. Stand on my shoulders, right? So I sponsor, I'm sponsoring right now a couple young women in their 30s. I'm saying, don't miss out. Don't miss out. I missed out on my childbearing years because I was eating. Don't do that. Stand on my shoulders. Don't do that, right? So I'm so grateful that I was just willing to follow direction. I'm really, really grateful. And this was interesting. This is one of the post-its on the wall. So about 10 years ago, I was leading a meeting, and I shared about my brother who had died of diabetes, right? And my brother got diabetes at 15, and he died at 36. And he died a horrendous death. You know, he lived in an old people's home for the last 3 years of his life. He had, both of his legs were gone, right? He was on dialysis for the last year and a half of his life, and he went blind. And once he went blind, he said, that's it. I'm not going to live blind. Take me off dialysis. And he was dead over a weekend. And I'd shared that, right? And I said that when you're diabetic, right, and you lose both your legs, it's not like they just take both your legs. They start with the little toe, then the next two, then below the ankle, then above the ankle. Then they start working on the left leg if they've started on the right. I mean, it just literally, my brother was literally losing his body piece by piece because in addition to his diabetes, my brother, like me, had an eating disorder and couldn't stop eating sugar. And he couldn't stop. Same thing happened to my mother years later. She was 66 when she got the less serious diabetes. Good luck with that. And 2 years later, she was in a bed, both legs gone. Same thing, just happened quicker. And she, like me, my mother was 250 pounds when she died. My brother was 120. The two different sides of diabetes. And she just could not stop eating sugar. Neither could my brother. Why? They weren't ready to feel the feelings. So I was at a meeting, and I'd shared that story. And a woman came up to me, and she said two things. She said, first of all, she said, I just think, I don't know if anybody's told you, she said, but maybe you shouldn't tell that story about your brother like that. I said, ooh, what should I, you know, remember? Uh-oh, we're in the ring. Uh-oh, you got two addict types, right? We're heading into the ring. I said, what story isn't it, shouldn't I tell? She said, well, that one about your brother and how he lost his legs, that's really scary. You're scaring people. I said, you know what? What's your name? Jane? Yeah, okay, you're Lane and Jane. I said, I actually am trying to scare people. It's scary what happens here. And for some reason, we think in Overeaters Anonymous that it's not a big deal or that we're not paying a price, that it's not the same as alcoholism or drug addiction. Because I talk to people all the time. 95% of the people that call me, I wouldn't know them if they were standing behind me at Trader Joe's. And people will say, like, well, and inevitably what comes up in a conversation, I know how to have a conversation. I'm not mean to people. I'm not mean, but I'm clear. And if you just got off sugar 3 days ago and somebody is saying something to you that's clear, it's going to seem mean. It is. I have been hurt by my father. I am not mean. I know how to have a conversation. My background is social work. I know what it means to be vulnerable and tender and fragile. I know how to have a conversation. But if we're on the phone and you want to have a conversation, well, let's have a conversation. And inevitably, something is going to come up that you hadn't put two and two together about. And it's going to seem like I'm being mean. And usually what will then come up is, well, I mean, it's working. I haven't had sugar since Monday. And by the way, I'm talking to them on Thursday, right? So they're saying, I mean, I haven't had it for 3 days. It's like, oh, okay, yeah. Imagine if you were talking to a heroin addict who'd been at it for 20 years, right, banging for 20 years, and they said, well, I haven't done it. I haven't mainlined since Monday. Lighten up. It's Thursday. Like, you'd really get it that way, but somehow we have this idea that there's something innocuous about sugar or quantity eating, right? It's not for me. I mean, the rest is, you know, there's abstinence and there's food plans. I don't want to get into that conversation, right? Definitely not. But it's not with sugar. And, you know, my sponsor tells me it's fine. I don't sponsor anybody if you want to eat sugar, you know. And it's no big deal, right? Look, if you're drowning, a blue boat, a red boat, a purple boat, a green boat, pink boat can save your life. Just get out of the water. Get in a boat! Right? Get in a boat. You're drowning. And the sharks are circling. And they're hungry. So get in a boat. And if you got in my boat, you got in a red rowboat. And presumably you got in my boat because you want what I have. Because with all due respect, I don't want what you have. So I'm assuming then you're gonna take the directions that I'm giving you. You can call them suggestions if you want. You can call them butterflies if you want, right? But my expectation is that people are going to do what I've asked them to do. That's my expectation. Why? That's not my good idea. Aside from the fact, if somebody's in my rowboat, they are now part of a lineage of good sponsorship. My sponsor has a sponsor who has a sponsor. So you're now part of something bigger than you, and we're going to be working from the source material. Right? The primary source material, the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that book is full of direction. Full of directions. Over 140 directions in there, between the you shoulds, you must, etc. The thing's full of direction. There's all kinds of directions in there. So we're gonna get moving. We're gonna get moving right away. And if you don't wanna do that, that's fine. Of course this isn't the only way to recover. I don't have any illusions that I can do something with chronic slippers that Cindy can't do, or John can't do, or Alana can't do. I don't have a messianic complex about this. I don't. But I do have my experience. Experience is valuable. And I was a slipper. And I've sponsored slippers exclusively for the last dozen years. So I do, that's a valuable thing to contribute. So if you want to be in my boat, that's great. And if you don't, no problem. You don't need to jump back in the water. Don't jump back in the water, right? I'm going to row you up alongside another boat. I'm going to get you right up alongside Alana's catamaran. She's got a catamaran. I'm going to hold your hand while you're getting on her catamaran. I'm going to be rowing away, blowing kisses. She's going to be whatever catamarans do. She's going to be catamaraning away with you on the boat, right? And I'm going to be, as I said, blowing kisses, hoping you're going to remember the telephone tool that we have in Overeaters Anonymous, because those tools aren't just perfunctory things we read in meetings. You're supposed to be working those on a daily basis. So I'm hoping you're going to be making those outreach calls, reminding you what I taught you, what was taught to me about making outreach calls. Why? So that you don't have to be alone. It's not a punishment. It's not a punishment if I say to my sponsees, which I do, five meetings, five commitments. It's not a punishment. It's so that you don't have to be alone anymore. It's really a love thing. What I'm really saying is I'm mandating that you start showing up for the love. That you stop settling for less. You know? And let yourself know that you are loved here and valued here. And your value has nothing to do with what you weigh. It's none of my business what anybody weighs. It is so none of my business. Do not be one of those people in Overeaters Anonymous who, and I don't want to go too far with this, but don't be one of those people who's unkind. It's supposed to be a safe place in Overeaters Anonymous. It's not my business what anybody else weighs, and it's not yours either. Be kind. Just be loving and kind. It's really painful. Who's that comedian that we just lost another comedian, another overweight comedian, Ralphie May? Yep. It's already unsafe out in the world to be an overweight person. It's the only prejudice that's still actively sanctioned in society. You know, they build sitcoms around this prejudice.
And it's funny to make jokes, call names, laugh and stuff. Make this a safe place. Here's what I can tell you. It's all about pain. It's all about pain. So how do I make it safe for somebody to know that you can fall in my arms? You can fall in my arms and I will drag you to the winning side. That's what I'm to do here. And that's what we are to do here, I think. And so I just want to make sure that it's a really safe place. And Cindy, where are we at on time?
That was 10, yeah.
Oh, very good. So I've got 5 now?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the other thing that woman said at the meeting. Is she said, or it might not have been, I might be confusing, this might have been another meeting. It's hard to believe she would have stood around to, you know, take, you know, have more of a conversation with me after I basically said, I'm not going to stop talking about it. As a matter of fact, I feel like you should give me your phone number and I'm going to record it on your voicemail, right? But, so I just can't, you know, right? More work to be done. More Al-Anon, right? But at another meeting, it was another meeting. Now I'm realizing it was another meeting. But I had shared this thing about working the steps despite the fact I wasn't abstinent. And this woman came up to me afterwards and she said, you can't do that. You can't work the steps in Overeaters Anonymous if you're not abstinent. And I said, oh, I can't? And she said, no, you can't do that. And I said, okay, all right. Well, I guess that sponsor of mine a kajillion years ago was wrong, right? And I guess the 7 years I have now, right, doesn't matter because I shouldn't have ever started it, according to you. What was your name again, right? I mean, I just, you know, but again, I keep, you know, restraint of pen and tongue, and largely, thank you, Al-Anon, I kept my mouth shut, and I went home and said something to my sponsor. My sponsor said, you know, bless her, change you, and just let go, right? Let go, and you're just fine, and just keep going, right? So I kept going. And then 2 years later, once I got that sponsor who directed me for the month that we were working together, or 2 weeks, whatever it was a short period of time, right? And she's the one who directed me to 5 meetings and 5 commitments. So I had gone to a meeting on a Sunday morning, because I have to now change my life around to keep access, right, so that I keep having a life, but I forgot that part of it. But I have to change my life around because I got to bring some meetings in because I got to get these, you know, nitwit commitments. And so I go to this meeting that I never usually go to, and they were reading from the OA 12 and 12, which is a wonderful book. I've read that book 3-4 times, done that workbook 3-4 times over the years. And we were on step 4, and we were all reading. You'd read a paragraph, and then we'd share on it. And the paragraph I got was the one that started at the bottom of 30 and wraps around to 31, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says, and this book was written in either 1990 or 91. And I'd gotten the direction from my sponsor, remember, in 1998, but you are dependent upon a lineage of good sponsorship, and clearly I had a good sponsor, because what that book says is, we think it's a good idea that you would be abstinent before you work a 4-step. However, maybe working a 4-step, even if you're not abstinent, is going to be the catalyst for you to actually conclusively take a 3rd step. So I thought, bingo, right? And I thought 2 things. I thought, I am so grateful for that sponsor who directed me 2 years before that book came out to work the steps, despite the fact I wasn't abstinent. And I wish I could remember the name of that woman from that meeting. But you guys are laughing. I just want to give her an outreach call. Right? No, I'm kidding. Right? No. Bless her, change me. But I'm just so grateful. But again, that just reminded me, I'm grateful I kept my mouth shut in that conversation. Are you with me? Like, all of a sudden you start seeing the wisdom of the things that are in the book, the direction I get from sponsors, the idea of having 9 tools now. You know, if somebody has a handle on what plan of action it is, please explain it to me. You probably know, Nicole. Explain it to me, right? So, like, but we're supposed to be working those on a daily basis. And thank God that you just start looking back over your life and you see where all these things contributed to a wonderful story that is continuing to unfold. And why would I, just as I'm heading home, why would I why would I want to stop coming? Why would I want to walk out of here and say, I think I've got enough. I think my cup is full. Because the thing is, you come here, right? And the cup fills up, and it fills up quickly. But what has happened, in my experience, through working the steps, my cup stays full, but I'm expanding. My heart's expanding, right? The irony, right? My spirit's expanding through the transformation that happens through the step work, and my body is contracting because the transformation that happened to my body is the least interesting transformation that's happened to me here. It's the least interesting. I'm glad I don't weigh 200 pounds anymore. It's good for my health. My doctors are glad, right? It feels better. There's a whole host of things that actually work better for me weighing 135 than 200. But it doesn't have anything to do with my value. It doesn't have anything to do with my heart, right? What does have to do with my heart space is all the work that I have done and will continue to do through working the 12 steps.